From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the August 2016 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Enigma from the Other Side. This month, for the first time, we hear from a German Enigma operator. Irmgard Enger joined the Air Force when she turned 21. The alternative was to work in a munitions factory. After 3 months' training in codes and teleprinters, she was posted to an airbase in France. From there, she sent top-secret messages about planes crashing on their way to and from bombing raids of Britain. It was crucial to the German war machine that the Allies didn't find out how many German bombers crashed or how bad things were at the munitions factories, which were also being bombed. We'll hear about her work, social life, and how friendly or otherwise French people were to the German military, as well as what happened when the airbase she was at was bombed. Also this month, we'll take you to BBC Floggett's Valuation Day at Bletchley Park, which might just have been the wettest in 15 years of making the show. Antiques from intricate commemorative spoons up to furniture bigger than its owner and even a sink were brought to the mansion for valuation by the long-running show's experts. And we met a man who grew up just outside the boundary fence of Bletchley Park during World War II. But first, change is afoot at the 1940s boutique. Just in case you haven't heard me talking about this event before, it's a day-long workshop in hair and beauty techniques of the 1940s and 50s. The hostess with the mostest and teacher is Sarah Dunn of Sarah's Doo Wop Doos, an expert in vintage glamour. It's been running for 2 hugely successful years now, with up to 25 participants in groups that range from 1 up to 3 generations of the same family, coming to learn and turn themselves into style icons. Now it's getting a makeover, and soon you'll be able to book in for a spot of vintage styling by Sarah and her team of experts. I went along to the July boutique to find out more.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Till I come marching home.
Sarah, here we are back at the 1940s boutique in the lovely iconic Victorian mansion at Bletchley Park. But change is blowing through this boutique, isn't it? What's new? What's coming?
Well, we've got some really exciting new Pamper Days basically coming. And what the idea is that we're going to offer you the chance to get made up. So 1940s hair and makeup, have a really nice relaxing morning, have a look around the park, maybe do a little bit of shopping at the Clarabelle's Closet pop-up shop. You know, it's going to be a really nice indulgent experience. You know, come with a friend, come with a family member, come with a group of girls and basically try the look of the 1940s without the hassle of having to do it yourself. I will be on hand with my team and we'll be making sure you look, you know, 1940s perfection.
It's a whole other strata of people that might be interested, isn't it? Because you do this at home, don't you, in your parlour, in your front room?
Absolutely, yeah. No, I have a home salon and, you know, my clients that come to the home salon, you know, they might want a lesson, but a lot of the time they're going out for an evening or they're maybe, you know, going out with friends or they're doing it as a, you know, a fun day, you know, just an experience.
Isn't it?
Completely, completely. And, you know, it's such a fun look and there's so many styles. There's not just victory rolls. You know, there's lovely classic hair sets. I'd love to encourage people to find a picture they like and, you know, bring it with them. You know, this is your chance to have the look you've always wanted to try a bit of vintage, but to try something exciting and fun and just, you know, step outside of your normal kind of comfort zone, try something unusual.
So we met lots of people who've come through the boutique who've had taken that sort of, it's quite a brave step to try and do it yourself and be in a room full of strangers and try something you've never done before, that perhaps you're not an expert in hair and makeup, but of course by the end of the day they pretty much are, and they know how to do that particular thing that you've taught them how to do. But this takes all that kind of stress out of it. It's just an indulgent pampering experience.
Exactly. And the idea is that, you know, it's like booking in for a salon, but in the most beautiful surroundings you could book into a salon, because you're at Bletchley Park. You've got the history, you've got the atmosphere, but you're also having a really lovely day out and you're getting made up. And then obviously you're out in the park in your look. I mean, today we've had some of the girls here that have come previously and they're all dressed up and they're on site and they're just enjoying the experience. And I think that's something that I think is happening more and more at the park. I don't know if you agree that people come dressed up because it's Bletchley Park and they're into vintage and they're into history. They might be reenactors, but they're enjoying being in their clothing at this site. And I think that's a really nice part of people coming here.
I think it speaks of the sort of increase in popularity of that, speaks of how popular vintage fashion is and the success of Clara Brown's Closet as a pop-up shop here. And
that's been amazing,
online,
yeah.
And the fact she's doing lots of events and she's busier than ever. It all just suggests that there's a real wave towards this. What do you think is behind that?
I've worked with Claire at Clara Brown's Closet for a couple of years now, and we met out on the sort of car show circuit. But, you know, the sort of clothing she has, she goes from, you know, really bright reproduction clothing to beautiful, you know, 40-style clothing. She carries plus size, she has accessories, it's the whole deal. And people love to come in and try on and everything and just see how they look in something. These styles are so flattering. I mean, you're wearing a beautiful blouse from her. And, you know, they're such a flattering style. Whatever size you are, whatever style you are, you'll probably find something. And you can just try something a little bit glamorous, a little bit elegant, a little bit different. The parlour, I mean, it's such a nice thing to have for us because my clients will shop. You know, they'll come in, they'll do the hair and makeup lesson, but they'll also shop, they'll buy things. You know, I'm telling them about snoods, headscarves and felt flowers. Well, they can get them literally the other side of the door. And, you know, then they'll try the hair and they'll dress it up. And it's just a really nice thing. I think with vintage, it's the popularity of it's huge. And I think it's almost crossed over to the mainstream. It's almost like now it's out there as just another thing to wear. You know, if you're going to a wedding, you might just wear a vintage dress because it's now a completely acceptable thing to do.
I think the eyeliner, for example, and the red lipstick are a kind of a signature look of now, as much as
very
they are
much
a nod to that period in vintage.
I think it's become completely acceptable. And I mean, yeah, I just think vintage, like the look, the red lips, you know, it's very red carpet, isn't it? It's very Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's just very classic glamour. I think, you know, I wear red lipstick every day, you know, and it's sort of, a lot of the ladies here, well, ladies who already wear red lipstick, they can do a little bit of eyeliner. But, you know, try it out. It could be for you.
Do you get a lot of comments and people asking you questions about your look when you're out and about?
Yeah.
Do you feel like you're sort of your own shop window?
Well, yeah, you have to be. I mean, I've been hairdressing now, or, you know, styling, and as a makeup artist as well, for sort of, you know, getting on, it must be getting on for 10 years. I don't want to give away my age, but, you know, I'm older than I was when I started. And it's sort of, I think my look sort of progressed with it, you know, as I've got more confident with it. Obviously, I wear the bigger hair. And you are, like I said, you are your shop window. So, you know, I wear lots of vintage and I don't really have an off-duty look anymore. I just sort of have, like...
Do you own a pair of jeans?
I do, but they are vintage workwear jeans.
Oh, there you go.
They're like 1940s style denim, but they're great. Even stuff like that, you know, that you can get that now. And it's, you know, so you can do this sort of off-duty glamour, you know, T-shirt, denim, you know, Converse. So I do, you know, don't wear my big skirts for dog walking, but you still kind of keep the look.
And it's a state of mind, perhaps.
I think so. I mean, it's lovely. And what the boutique sort of does and what people find out when they come for the Pamper Days is what you can achieve that's a vintage look but with modern styling. You know, I use a modern tongue, I'm using modern hair products, all things that wouldn't have been available in the 40s. And on the workshops, I get to teach people that and talk about the austerity and, you know, the side of it, which is terribly unglamorous and quite distressing and, you know, a world that wasn't in a great shape and what came out of that was so positive and incredibly glamorous. And then with the Pamper Days, you know, people are going to see that in action. And, you know, it's lovely when people get their hair and makeup done and they can watch what you're doing as well. You know, it's a nice experience being in the salon. It's just sort of, it's quite relaxing having your hair done. People tend to, you know, take 5, close their eyes for a little bit.
Well, I'm sure it will be tremendous fun.
I'm looking forward to it, yeah. Looking forward to it.
Claire Alexander. So, you run Clarabella's Closet. First of all, bear in mind, this is just audio, so while I'm getting a visual feast here, the listener isn't. So can you describe the sort of thing that you have at Clarabella's Closet for us?
Mainly vintage reproduction dresses, some 40 styles, some 50 styles, in nice vibrant prints, classic court. Also handmade hair accessories, hair flowers, rockabilly headbands, jewellery, hair snoods. Everything, really.
And is this mostly you reselling things that other people have made and you having the eye to go and find the things that you think fit your theme? And
yeah, mainly. I mean, I do make my own dresses, but I haven't had time for a good 6 months now.
That's probably a good sign.
Yes, but I do spend a lot of time sourcing the correct kind of accessories and apparel for Clarabella's Closet.
So this must be a network, if you like, behind you of sort of individual, maybe quirky might seem a bit of a patronising word in this context, but it's very niche kind of stuff that these people are making, and How on earth, you know, do you find them?
Well, I've got a couple of suppliers and I've had long-standing working relationships with them, and they've, you know, I trust them, they trust me, and, you know, I keep an eye on what they're bringing out and the styles and everything. And also I meet up with people who make their own accessories.
And how did you get started doing what you're doing? Because it sounds like you've got busier and busier.
I have, yes. In 2004, I started on eBay, tabletop business, while the kids were in bed at night, you know, taking photos. I sold everything from underwear, caftans. And then I was able to start the vintage reproduction, which is what I'd always wanted to do, because I've always loved the styles and everything. And then I was put in a position financially where I could go out and do that. So over the last four and a half years, it's gone from there, really.
So are there boxes and rails of stuff filling every spare inch of your house? Is it all in the garage?
Yeah, I have a workshop, but it's full of because of the handmade stuff as well, and the flowers. I've really started working on the handmade flowers. And
so you make those?
I do, yes. I do now, yes, yeah. And the felt ones as well. I sit there for hours sewing felt, and I really enjoy it, and it's very therapeutic. So when I have a day off, I don't necessarily have a day off. I just want to go and make things. It gives me the clarity that I need to recharge again and get on with what I do.
Sounds like you're a great example of finding something you love and then finding a way to make it make money.
Well, that's it, yeah. It took a few years to find out what actually worked for me and that. But, yeah, it's working online, and I've just gone on to Etsy as well with a handmade. Ooh. So I'm hoping that'll become more successful.
That's a very well-promoted portal, isn't it?
Yeah. Although I carry a couple of other brands, I'd like it to be mainly my accessories that I make myself. Because
and Bletchley Park's quite a good fit for you, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Marketplace for you to shop window to be in.
Oh, like. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we've been received very well. And it's really lovely and everybody's really nice. And people come in and they go looking through everything. And like this morning, there's a lady come in, she didn't know we were here. She's gone away with two dresses, and that's a part of it that I enjoy, where people say, oh, I could never wear anything like that, but they see themselves in them and, you know, they love it. So
they've probably never tried anything on that kind of cut before, because it's not really around so much now.
Yeah, when I go on the trade show circuit as well, I've made friends from it because they've tried on dresses, and predominantly a lot of people plus size, they wouldn't usually think, oh, I won't feel comfortable in that. Yeah, this morning there's a lady gone out and one of these cream dresses here, and she looked fantastic in it.
How did you get into this vintage era style in the first place? What sort of drew you into it? Can you even remember? Has it been a lifelong?
Well, it's always with my dear Nan, really. She's 95 now, and I remember growing up.
She'd have been a young girl around when this was.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's always fascinated me. It's sort of the classic styles, the way, you know, everything's put together. It's glamour, and it's just something about it. It's just like almost. For me, so it's. I sometimes think I live in the wrong era. You know, I was born in the wrong era, because I'd love to go back and say, I know it wasn't all glamour all the time, but everybody was just so neatly turned out, and the hair, and people used to go shopping with the hair and the baskets and all that. I just fell in love with that. And when I went into a unit, my nan came to see me, and it was all done out in the vintage with the glass cabinets and everything. And she came and she sat in the middle of it, and a little tear came down her face, and she said, "You're just taking me back." And I think for a lot of people, it does. So for me, it's just lovely, and it's lovely to see some people wearing the vintage reproduction and the true vintage as well.
Long may it continue.
Oh, yes.
And there's someone looking like
looking at
a
the
bit
dress,
of advice,
that dress
so
again.
I'll,
yes.
I'll leave it to your customers.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Flog It is a BBC daytime antiques show with an audience of more than 2 million people. As the host, Paul Martin, told us, the premise is pretty simple. Bring your treasure to be valued, decide you want to flog it, and the show's cameras come with you to auction.
This isn't your first visit to Bletchley Park, is it?
No, I came here about 14 years ago.
What a difference you must say.
A very big difference, yeah. Well, yeah, and hopefully it's going to grow and grow and grow.
What were your impressions then, and what do you see today that's so different?
My first impressions 14 years ago were, it's purely for academics. It felt a bit stuffy, but it was full of history. You know, absolute history. Today, coming back here, I feel like I've stepped back in time, you know, to the 1940s, and there's something quite special that I can lock into rather than just be somebody from the outside. So for me, there's been a big improvement. The storytelling's better.
Excellent. That's good to hear. And of course, in terms of storytelling, it couldn't get much better than meeting someone who was here and worked here. And you've just been talking to Joanna Chorley, who worked on Colossus.
Absolutely fantastic.
So what did you chat about?
Well, I mean, what Colossus did and how it was manned, how it was operated, what the atmosphere was like at the time during the war, learning about the academics, obviously that worked here. And just the personal attachment, you know, the stories about, you know, throwing the loo roll over the tree and, you know, getting the bus home and not really being able for her to take part in the social side of things, which I know would have been, you know, pretty good here because there was such a high concentration of workers in a small space.
And there were, a lot of them were young.
And a lot of them were young, yeah. Exactly.
A bit of a campus atmosphere.
Yes, yeah.
With so that military was nice. Constraint, but, you know.
So that was nice. That was nice. And the fact that it was all top secret and you couldn't tell your parents, you couldn't tell your friends.
So you shared this secret with these people that you worked with. There must have been something quite bonding about that, wasn't there?
Yeah, I would. Yes, yeah. I mean, I've never been in that situation, but I imagine that you were all in this together and you looked after one another. And there was this sort of, it was almost like a community spirit going on with a community that's sort of not involved with where you live, if you know what I mean. I know it doesn't make sense, but that kind of thing.
So you must meet a lot of people who are bursting with their own sort of personal histories attached to these items that they bring to Flogget to tell. So you must get a lot of very personal.
Yes, that's kind of what the show's about, really. It's not necessarily about the value of what's it worth. You know, it's a bit vulgar to put a price on something, you know, because we're looking at items that are sort of vignettes into the past, windows into the past, and it doesn't matter what it is, if it's a piece of porcelain, if it's a picture, if it's something like that. It's a piece of social history. It becomes a document because there's a place and a time, especially if it's signed and dated by a master and a maker. And I think that's what the show's all about, really. It's flagging up great British craftsmanship. And it can have a value of £50 as long as it's made beautifully, the best example of its kind, and it's British, and it tells a regional story. It's got an identity. I think that's the key to Flogget. That's the key to, you know, why it's lasted 15 years and we're going to be making our 1,000th show here.
People have to make the decision before they come that they want to sell this thing.
Yeah.
That's the premise of the show.
It's right, it's called Flog It. Yeah, okay, not yeah. Keep It.
So do they sometimes change their minds is what
yes,
I'm trying
they
to
do.
Get at and find
yes,
it quite difficult
do.
To part with things
yeah,
when they know a bit more about it?
Yeah, they do. Once they've heard more about it, they kind of think, oh gosh, you know, I haven't heard that story. Maybe I should hang on to it. But by that time, they're caught up in the whole TV thing. They've let go of it at the valuation day. And there's 3 or 4 weeks in between before the auction happens, and sometimes things do get withdrawn. Sometimes they ring the auctioneer up and they put the reserve up because they don't want to let it go for £200 to £300. So they say, no, like, actually £300 the reserve now, it's a bit special, I don't really want to let it go for that. So we do get a lot of that, and I do get upset when some people come in and they've got granddad's medals for sale, and I'm saying, hang on a minute, you know, he's lost his life in the war. A lot of brave young men have, you know, that was the Great War. Why are you selling these medals? You know, is there nobody else in the family that wants them? They say, oh, they've been in a drawer, you know, the ribbons are frayed, we don't look at them, we don't want them. And I'm thinking, well, they shouldn't be in a drawer. They should be mounted in a diorama behind a glass and on the landing somewhere where you walk past or in the hallway every day, and you feel proud of what your family has contributed, you know, to towards this country. You know, they're your ancestors, and once it's sold in auction, it's gone forever. You can't buy it back. You know, the auctioneer is duty bound not to tell you who he sold it to. You can't actually ring them up and say, oh, I've changed my mind, I want to buy it back. So I get really upset, and I do kind of push that home before we start filming.
Does that ever get onto camera and into the show, that
sometimes
sort of persuasion?
Sometimes I say, look, are you sure you want to sell this? This is your family history. It's worth an awful lot more to you in sentimental terms than it is to somebody else in monetary terms. Yeah. And you can't put a price on sentiment and lost life. That does kind of annoy me, you know, the medal situation or anything that's really personal. That was grandmother's and she did something outstanding in her life and they haven't got a lot else to remember her by. You know, she may have made this needlework sampler and signed it when she was 7 years old and weaved her name into it and it's been in the family all its life and they decide to sell it. That's annoying.
It does. Yeah, I can appreciate that. I see what you mean.
But look, everybody's got needs, you know, and they want to declutter. They've seen it. They don't want it anymore.
Well, where do you draw that line? It's personal, isn't it?
We sell it. It's very difficult. If they want to go through with it.
No, I mean, for each person, it's different.
It's totally different.
Personal. So what matters enough to keep and what doesn't invoke those memories for them, those fond memories.
Yeah.
I threw a clock away the other day and you're making me feel guilty about it.
Yeah. It is difficult, but obviously you've got other things of mum's, you know, and as you say, the clock doesn't work anymore. It costs more to mend than it would to, you know, go out and buy a new one that's more reliable. So people are changing. I've noticed over the last 15 years, you know, they're not hanging on to so much. I think everybody's deciding to live for the future rather than the past. So
it does speak to me of the importance of oral history.
Yes.
So they're actually gathering, because there are things I wish I'd asked members of my family before it was too late. And you need to think of what you want to know while they're here to ask, don't you?
Yes.
And actually, it's the memories that are attached to an item that are more important than the item itself.
Exactly. That's what we're finding. Yeah, but it's sometimes those items evoke those memories.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
hand in hand. And, you know, if it's out of sight, it's out of mind. That's the problem.
You're not actually going into people's lofts and saying, right, I'll have that.
No.
they have chosen to bring it. It's their decision.
Yeah. They come along and a lot of the time they just want to get on telly and they want their item valued, which is great. And then they end up saying, gosh, I didn't know it was worth that sort of money. Would you know what? If it's worth £2,000, I don't really like it that much. I want to sell it. That'll pay for a holiday and that'll pay to get the car through its MOT and whatever, the kids' school uniform. Do you know what I mean? People have busy lives. They've got bills to pay.
There's honesty baked into Flog It.
It's all about the people.
Antiques Roadshow is a little bit more circumspect about, they don't make a decision.
No, they don't have to. No.
Whether they want to sell it. And that's why you get people betting on whether they thought it was more or less than
I mean, a lot of journalists have described Flog It as the Antiques Roadshow without the sentimentality. You know,
I don't think so.
But we do have the sentimentality. We may be slightly more mercenary about our objects, you know, our owners will be. But there's a definite honesty about it. Yes, there is. There
Most
really
of those
is.
People on an Antiques Roadshow are there because they want to know how much it's worth.
Exactly. You know, and I've got stuff that, let's say, I don't have an Aunt Edna, but I'll use that as a cliche. My Aunt Edna's given us stuff, you know, a bit of Claris or a Royal Doulton vase. That's pretty awful. You know, we put it underneath the kitchen sink in the cupboard, out of sight, out of mind. What are we going to do with that? And 5 years later, you find it and it's got a bit of mould on it and you've never looked at it. And go, well, I don't really like it.
It makes you feel guilty when you look at it.
Yeah, so, you know, I want to sell stuff that my relations and relatives have given me.
I'll tell you
me,
what,
so.
You should go to Bletchley Park tomorrow then. Get in the queue nice and early.
I'll be there winding them up, jollying it along. It'll be good fun. And if the weather's like it is today, we're going to have a cracking day. It's going to be really good.
Certainly are. We look forward to it. Thank you.
Well, I tell you what a turnout we have here today, despite the weather. And I cannot wait to look around this fascinating site.
I know.
This lot are raring to go to, laden with antiques and collectibles. If you're happy with the valuation, what are you going to do? Let's do it. Well done, everyone.
What's your name, sir?
Michael Hutt.
And I'm told you lived very near to Bletchley Park growing up.
I lived in what Bletchley Park calls the farmhouse. I came there in 1938. I was 9 months old then. When Lady Leon died, her estate was split up, and a chap called Captain Ingram bought 600 acres of the estate and then asked my father to come and be stud groom for him. And that's how we came to become here. There was two farmhouses and there was another big house which they've knocked down now, which the captain lived in, that one. And we lived in the top one. Nobody lived in the bottom one ever all my life. So I was here till I was 22 altogether. We had no flush toilets, no electric. So
different times.
Yes, different
So
different
all through
world.
The war?
Yes, during the war. My two cousins came down as evacuees and they was here for about 3 years with us, something like that, altogether. So there was three of us down here.
Where were they from?
They was from East London, Forest Gate. But I was an only child, so all of this area was my playground. I always say they built Milton Keynes on my playground, you know.
Do you live in this area now?
I live at Shenley now, yes. I've never moved out the area. I've moved two or three places within Bletchley, and then when I retired I went to Shenleywood Retirement Village and I now live up there.
Oh, it's lovely, isn't it, though?
It's beautiful.
It's like
up there.
Cruise ship on the ground, isn't it?
It is, yeah. My wife said it's like a hotel.
Yeah.
There's loads to do, plenty of activities, and all the help with everything, you know.
What do you remember this place being like in your childhood?
It was a very happy area. To give you an idea of the layout, all the ground of Lady Leon's was sold, apart from the big house. And then they took land away from us and built the huts, which became what Bletchley Park is all about today. At the back of the house, there was a RAF camp. Eventually, halfway through the war, the RAF camp was split in half and the other half became prisoner of war camp. We had to start growing food for the war effort, and as well as the horses. So the prisoners of war used to work on the harvest and haymaking and whatever was needed on the farm to do. And there was an anti-aircraft gun. They used to feed the prisoners. And us as children then, when we had our dens in the spinneys, and when the prisoners came for their dinner, they was given half a loaf of bread. They pulled the middle out of the heart at the loaf, and then they had two ladles of soup put into the crust. And we used to knock on the window and catch crusts of bread and ladles of soup and take them back to the den. But there was so much to do on the farm, and you had so many people to meet and have fun with. There was the RAF, the prisoners of war, the anti-aircraft men, the farm.
You did actually live in interesting times, as they might be called,
didn't
you?
Absolutely.
Of course, you don't know that as a child, do you? You just take for granted what happens around you. But what a fascinating way to look back on what were world events that you couldn't have known.
That's right.
The scale of what you were in the middle of at that time. Do you remember anything about Bletchley Park and the secret work that was going on here and knowing anything about
it? Nobody knew. My parents used to talk about it. Everybody wondered what was going on here, but nobody could find out. Nobody would spill the beans. We knew that Winston Churchill came here.
So you knew it must be important?
Yes, but no, they just used to say, he's here for a rest, you know. But
his little country retreat.
Yeah, later on, of course, it wasn't a rest. We now know why he was here. But that's about all you knew about Bletchley Park, because nobody would breathe a word.
What did you make of it when it started to come out in the 70s and 80s?
We was really surprised. I think my parents was really surprised as well, because they just didn't know. But there were so many people in here. You know, there's hordes of people going in and out the gates in the morning and the evening when they all went home. A lot of them was in lodgings all around the town, but nobody would speak. And there's one story that where two sisters worked in here and neither of them knew that the other one worked here.
I can well believe that, because the way they were so compartmentalised and
that's
kept
right.
so separate, and you only talk to people you worked with about the work and everybody else. It's probably made for a better social life because they couldn't talk about their work.
Yeah, I never got into the big house here until they opened up Bletchley Park.
So when they did, were you sort of hungry to get a look inside and see what it was like?
Yes, it's a very nice house. Yeah. It's an unusual house, because I don't know whether you've noticed, but the doors are split doors. And if you've got an oak room and a mahogany room, one side of the door is mahogany and the other side is oak. It's the only place in the country that's like it.
Lady Leon was, I gather, a well-liked figure around these parts. She Maybe your parents remembered her, do you
think? They came here after she was dead. Yeah. But Lady Leon was well-liked because she'd done an awful lot for the town. I think the most memorable thing what she'd done for the town at the railway station... A lot of horses was transported by railway in those days. She put a horse trough, and Fenny Stratford, it was built around a market, and she put a horse trough in Fenny Stratford. One of those horse troughs is in Stacey Hill Museum now, and nobody knows where the other one went to.
Oh, someone's got it in their garden with plants growing out of it, probably.
There's a sports field over the back here, what used to be, where the college and
the Leon Recreation Ground.
That's right. Yeah. She gave that to the town. That was all Lady Leon's ground.
Land,
and she gave that to the town. And there's Leon Rec down at Bletchley Road Schools.
I wonder what she'd have made of what happened after she died.
I wonder.
How this place went on to complete notoriety for very different reasons.
She was very good for the town, though. I think the town appreciated what she'd done and what she gave.
How do you feel as a Bletchley person, having grown up so many years not knowing what happened here and how important it was then to find out? How does that leave you feeling about Bletchley Park?
Quite surprised, I think, that something as important as this went on your doorstep and you didn't know nothing about it. But when you think about it, if you did know, everybody else knew, and it would never have worked. So it had to be as it was to work.
Quite right. Thank you very much.
Another rehearsal.
Well, that's it. That's the end of our day.
Keep waving your flags. Not now. You can stop now.
Irmgard Enger crossed the Great Divide. Born and raised in Germany, she came of age during World War II, so she did her duty and joined the Air Force at the age of 21. After training in codes and teleprinters, she was posted to an airbase in France, where she processed top secret messages. After the war, she did the unthinkable and married one of the enemy, an Englishman, after reluctantly going to a dance with a friend. A couple of years ago, Irmgard recorded her unique story as part of Bletchley Park's oral history project. Looking back on her war work and young life, she told Bletchley Park's oral history officer, Jonathan Byrne, what it was like from the other side.
Today, I'm with Mrs. Irmgard Copley, who, as Fräulein Enger, was a member of the Luftwaffe working as a communications operator. Mrs. Copley, could you please tell us how you came to join the Luftwaffe?
Well, when I was 21 years old, you know, I knew we had to go into the munition factories or go to in the forces. And so I joined the Air Force. But I had no idea they would send me to France and what I had to do there, you know. So I got a letter. I had to have a 3 month training to learn code and to learn teleprinting. I could write on an ordinary typewriter, but a teleprinter is just capital letters. And I done this for 3 to 4 months. And when I finished with the training, we were about 30 girls, all about my age, some were older. And then they decided where we had to work. And 2 girls were picked out to go to the airbase to Saint-Dizier in Francia. And that was my friend, Lotte, and me. We had to go there, report there, and we had to do work on a teleprinting machine. But for the first few months, we had to ordinary teleprinting, ordinary letters, you know, through the machines. They came to give us letters. We had to write to Berlin, to Breslau, to Cologne, all over the place we had to write, you know. And of course, later on, we had to do codes to these machines, you know, which was that GKDOS, Geheime Kommandosache. I never heard before that word. And so I came to France and do that work. But we didn't have this every day. We had 3 shifts, and every shift had so many of those to do, you know. Sometimes we had 1 a week, sometimes we had 1 a month, you know. And the war was going longer and longer. We had less and less and less, you know. But I certainly worked on it, and I had many, many hours to... We made mistakes. We had to do it all over again. It took us sometimes all evening, all night to get a proper writing, you know.
When were you sent to France?
About 1943.
And that was your first job after your training?
Yeah, well that was... They sent me to an airbase, Saint-Dizier. It was a small airbase. They had a Fernschreibstelle. And we had to work on that Fernschreibstelle to do ordinary German writing through the teleprinter.
So Fernschreibstelle, what would that be in English? Is that the teleprinter?
Der Teleprinter war ein Fernschreiber.
Ah, excellent.
Fernschreiber.
Thank you.
Yes.
That's
we didn't say teleprinter, Fernschreiber.
No, of course.
Fernschreiber, yes.
Can you remember what the Luftwaffe units that were based there were? What sort of aircraft they were?
Well, just remember, Nachrichten, Luftnachrichtenregiment 52, and there were night fighters. I think Messerschmitt. Yes. But we never saw the planes. We weren't even allowed to go to where the aircraft were parked. You know, it was everything so secret. We just had to go to unser Fernschaftsstelle, to this, and then finished.
I understand.
I never saw actually just from a distant plane taking off, but never close.
Could you tell us a little bit about what we call the Enigma machine? What did you call the machine, this machine?
Eine Schlüsselmaschine. Eine Schlüsselmaschine. I never seen one before. They brought us into the Fernschreibstelle, and it was quite easy to operate. A soldier showed to us, you know, I think he was an officer, and it came out here in German, you know. And what we had this printed, it got onto our machine in German, you know. That must have, I can't quite remember, isn't there a wire here?
But you think when you press the key, it was printed out onto paper?
It printed out on paper on our teleprinter machine.
That's very interesting, because that is something I don't think we understood before about the,
yes,
the use
there
of Enigma.
Must have been, I mean, there is a battery in it, isn't there, a battery? And it went onto our teleprinting machine, and it came in German out what we printed here. But you can see the letters come in German here, you know. If you write old, when the print is here, it comes here in German.
Did you have to set the...
No, not at all. It was all set already for us. Two soldiers bought the machine, and I set it up for us. I told you the code. We had a big letter with all five letters, and we had to feed it in there, and the proper writing came out in German.
You were just typing in the letters. Somebody else had set it up for you.
Yes. They bought us a machine. We had a little window. They put that thing through, and they told us, soon you will be finished with that machine. Telephone us, and they picked it up.
So they brought it to you.
They brought it to us.
And they took it away again.
They took it away. We didn't even know it was kept somewhere at the airport, but where they kept it, we don't know. Everything was secret about. We just had to do our job and not to talk about.
When you had a signal to decode, did one person work on it or two? Or?
No, when somebody came, when we had through our machine, they told us, I have a GKDOS für Sie. Ich habe eine geheime Kommandosache für Sie. And we knew GKDOS, we needed this machine.
So, as we might say, top secret. Or
top secret, yes. They didn't want the enemy to know how many machines were lost, how many they had to repair and everything, you know.
When you decoded the message, do you know who it went to?
It went to a high officer at the airport. But we didn't even met him. They just two soldiers with two guns. They had a gun here and they had a pistol here. They took that machine, they bought one. They took it away, and it was all. We never knew where it went to.
Did you sometimes have to turn messages into code to go out?
Very, very seldom. Yeah. Very seldom. At some, a lot of other girls done it in the day shift, you know. I normally had to do this at night, you know. But that was such I can't even remember everything. It's such a long time ago.
This is very interesting, so don't worry about that, please. Can you say a little bit more about what was in the messages? You've mentioned one or two things.
Yeah, but mostly when the Luftwaffe went to England and 30 aeroplanes went, perhaps five came only back. Yes?
Yes.
They were all shut down. And some of them, they crash landed, some of them, they dropped into the sea. And soon those that crash landed, they had to repair them quickly so they could take off again.
So the messages were details about crashes.
So the enemy shouldn't know how much aeroplanes were lost, you know, and how desperately they couldn't make so many, because the factories in Germany were made the aeroplanes, they were all bombed.
When you were decoding a message, was it an easy system to use?
Well, it took us sometimes a long time to get proper, you know, interference sometimes, you know. And we got it. We had to do it. We did not allowed to make mistake. For instance, if by, say, 10 aeroplanes and we would write 100. That would be a big mistake, you know.
Indeed. Did you ever have to start all over again with a message?
Sometimes we made mistakes, we had to do it all over again. Sometimes we were hours to do it.
Were you confident that the system you were using was safe, was secure?
Well, you know, I was young at the time. I never realised how important it was, really.
But nobody ever suggested that it might be capable of being broken, being deciphered by somebody else. You never heard that.
Well, we never thought that one of those machines ever went to England, to Bletchley Park. We never heard this word.
Can you tell me about the messages? When they were in code, what did they look like?
There were just a line with blocks of five letters. Always one block and then a little space and then next five. And about, what, one, two, three, about 20 in one sheet. We had to put this all through that machine, all these five letters. And out here came it in German writing. But I can't remember it. I think there must have been another way it came out on the teleprinting.
And it was letters, no numbers.
Well, numbers sometimes, you know. Yeah. Sometimes when they needed so many spare parts, 100 or 50 or 25, yeah. These were letters, you know.
But were the numbers, were they figures or were they words?
I believe they were letters.
Yes. So 100.
100 or 50 or 10 or 5. Yeah. Because here we couldn't write numbers, you know. It had to be all in letters.
That's what I thought, but I'm very glad to hear you confirm that. Thank you. What other machines were you using? You mentioned the teleprinter. Was there anything else that you used?
No, only teleprinter. Yes.
So no radio or telephone?
Well, we had to, no, telephone. We had to sometimes make a telephone call, you know. But no, we only had this machine and teleprinting machines. But they were very, very easy to operate. They were all capital letters, no small letters. And, you know, in the German language, we have, for instance, over the U, we have two little parts, it is Ü. We had to write a U and a E, that meant Ü. Because in this you couldn't get this, it was all written without stop or anything.
So was there a way by which you could recognise a full stop or a question mark?
No, we just leave a place and start again, but there was nothing, that was... came just like it is here, it came out.
Can you tell me a bit about the hours you worked? You worked on shifts, I believe.
Well, we worked on shifts. Well, I think from 8 o'clock, wait a minute, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, perhaps till 2 o'clock. Then from 2 o'clock, somebody else came to 6 or the 7 o'clock. And then the night shift, we normally started, we had to do all the night till in the morning, 7 o'clock, until the morning shift came again, you know. And of course, every shift had sometimes we had for a week, we didn't get anything. Some of the other girls got it, but we never talked about each other, never.
You never talked to the girls on another shift?
No, very, very seldom what we get, because I told us what you get through the machines, you just keep it to yourself. Even I went on leave home, you know, I never told my parents what I did.
Did they ask you? Did they want to know what you were doing?
No, they didn't ask. Well, I don't think my mother was interested.
And your friends at home?
They were all somewhere in munition factories or in the Air Force or in the Army. I think the Kriegsmarine, they didn't have girls. I can't remember. I don't think so.
Did you wear a uniform?
Yes. We had a blue uniform, blue-grey skirts and a jacket. We had the horrible swastika on it, you know, and we had to wear it when we went, had a shift. But when we finished with it, you know, when I came back to my living quarters, we could go in civilian clothes, so we could go into the town, we could go into a cafe, and I didn't know we were even Germans. I lived for quite a time at the airport. But later, and I must tell you, it was too dangerous because of the bombing. We had to go to the town and live privately. I think it was a hotel or somewhere, but it was guarded. And we felt safe there, you know. And there was a teleprinting in the cellar, and we had to do the teleprinting in the cellar.
So you were working in the cellar as well?
Yes,
as
we were working in the cellar there. Yes.
So how much time off did you get at the airbase?
Well, we had when we had night shift, we had 1.5 days free. We could do what we like. We could sunbathe. We could take our uniforms off. We could go civilian, you know, could go to the town, go have a meal in a French restaurant, you know. And don't forget, many, many French people that were very, very friendly to the Germans. But there were another lot which were just the other way, you know.
So you felt quite safe?
Felt quite safe, but only then 44, it was pretty different. Resistance was very active and they killed quite a lot of soldiers, you know, when they were out, you know, shot them and things like that.
Did you find that life got much more difficult then? Security was much tighter, was it then?
Yes. But I had many French people I knew.
What was the social life like on the base? Did you have any entertainment or anything?
We could go to the cinema, but seeing Hitler and things like that, you see. Because I will tell you, I haven't been brought up like that. My father was in a different party. He was in the SPD, you know. And that's why they arrested him and thousands of other people.
Did you have to travel far from your accommodation to work?
When we worked at the air base, we had barracks. Yeah. We had quite nice living barracks. At the air base, we worked on the top, you know. And I do remember it was a wooden building. And they had all brick walls all right when a bomb fell that we couldn't get splinters into our rooms. Yeah.
That's funny because at Bletchley Park, they have wooden huts.
Yes.
And they did exactly the same thing there. They built brick walls.
Yes, they had these old brick walls. We couldn't look outside. But if a bomb fell a little bit, you know, there came old splinters. Mm. We weren't hurt. We weren't hurt, you know. Unless we get a Volltreffer, if it went right.
Direct
on
hit.
Top. Yes. But then it was too dangerous, I thought of the bombing, you know. And we had to go to live outside in a house, and we lived about 10 girls together, you know. Each one had a different room, and it was guarded that nobody could come in, you know, that we were safe, you know. And then when the Americans landed in France, we had to go back to Germany. Oh, I haven't told you this. But I can't remember the date, that airbase I was on. You know, we could see nearly, not every night, but during the day, at night, go hundreds of aeroplanes go over to Germany, bombers, bombing Germany. But they never bombed that airbase. But one day they came, they turned. I was luckily not at the airport. I was outside in Saint-Dizier in the town. They turned round and they bombed that airbase to bits. That we couldn't go to work anymore. Gosh. And they sent me to Germany. That was 44.
And when you went back to Germany, were you still working on these machines?
No, I worked on an ordinary machine. Because in Germany, they invented one of those machines. You could get proper writing on its own. Big, big machine, but it was so secret we weren't even allowed to go on it.
That might be the Lorentz machine, possibly.
It might have been.
Like it. Much
I
bigger.
Had a look at it, but it was not like it was big. But you got a message through that machine, but if somebody tried, for England or America tried to get what was coming through the machine, they couldn't make head or tail of it, but it came on an ordinary typewriter. Properly, it was the latest machine, but it was all too late. They invented this.
But you didn't work. Did you?
I didn't work on this. Not in Berlin. No. Wiesenthal was the name. Wiesenthal. That's right. Yeah. Wiesenthal. But 50 kilometers east of Berlin, until the Russians came, and then I was sent back to West Germany, and then the war ended there. And I got my discharge papers, you know, I didn't do anything wrong in the war, I just did what I was told. I wasn't in the SS or anything.
So it must have been very difficult at the end of the war. What did you sort of do to start with? Did you find a job?
Well, we had to get our discharge papers, and then a British officer told us, if you like, you can work in a food factory. Mm. And I went voluntarily with three other girls, we worked in a food factory until everything was back to normal again, you know.
Did you meet anybody that you'd worked with before, or was everybody scattered?
Well, I didn't. There were only one girl I was really close to in the Air Force, but the other girls I didn't really. And a lot of girls I worked by on telephones.
You did tell me earlier you had a very good friend. Was it Lotte? Lotte, yes.
She went a different place and we got, what shall I say? I didn't know where she went. I went to a different place, you know. And, you know, I didn't even know for many years that she came out alive until quite about 10 years after the war, really. I knew that she was alive and then but she died of cancer, you know.
So you ended up living in England?
Well, where I worked in Germany, there were a lot of British, the army, and they had a dance somewhere in a big dancing place, you know, and they invited all German girls to come to a dance. And I said to the other girls, oh, I'm not going to see enemy dancing, you know, they put throw all bombs on us, you know, oh, come on, Irma, come, and we forget all about the war. And so I went down to enjoy. I met my husband. He didn't let me go.
Well, it's just as well you went, wasn't it?
Yes, and I never regretted it. No. We were nearly married 60 years, you know. And my husband, he knew all about what I was doing. I told him. He could have told you perhaps more than I could tell. I told him right from the beginning what I did, you know. And he has been stationed in India for a long time. And then he came to Italy, France, and then to Germany. His brother was killed in Italy. He went in Italy in Naples. There's at Vesuvius. He took a party of soldiers. He was a sergeant major. Soldiers up to Vesuvius and did explode.
Ah.
And you know, he got such a big piece of burning fire on his back and it killed him.
How awful.
Boxing Day 43 was killed, sad.
Very sad.
When I was stationed in Germany, in Biesenthal, so we knew we had, when the Russians came over the Oder, we knew we had to go, you know, otherwise they would have taken us all to Moscow, or they would have killed us all, the Russians, you know. They killed so many girls, you know. And so people who had parents in Eastern Germany, they could go to their parents, or we could go to the British zone, to Hamburg, you know. So I chose to go to Hamburg, you know. And they had to, oh my God, at that air base, it was not an air base, they were all teleprinting, you know. They had money, but it wasn't worth it. They gave us all money, but you couldn't buy much for it, you know, a lot of things. Because we didn't get wages right away, you know. The money we got from the Air Force was posted right to my bank in where I was born, you know. And we got just enough money we could get around from day to day, you know. But the main money was put into the bank, but it was all lost.
But that was no use if it was in the East, was it?
The Poles had it all, you know, so it was all lost, you know.
So this was German money at the time?
Occupation. But after a time, when the in the British zone, they bought different money out, you know. But I spent it all that. I spent it on the black market to get food for me.
Thank you.
My God, when I think on that time, I just can't believe it. I went all through that. And I was in the West, and I worked in that factory. I never worked in a factory before, but I didn't know what I had to. But we got paid, we got food, you know. And until the war, after half a year, it was getting more or less normal again to Germany. It was just in the first months, you know, it was terrible, terrible. But I wasn't married, it was quite all right. I had to only do it for myself, you know. But if I think on the time, I've forgotten many, many, many things, you know, many, many things. Somebody can't believe it, really. Can you make head or tail of it?
No, it's fascinating, and I'm glad you have remembered so much that it, you know, it does add to our story.
I can't remember everything.
Yeah,
no, just, you know?
That's okay, yeah.
So it is such a long time ago, my God.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy. Write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.